Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to a guest who made himself a guinea pig and tried several methods that are supposed to increase brain power. He'll let us know how it went and if they worked.
First, Governor Scott Walker has issued emergency declarations for three western counties, Eau Claire, Buffalo, and Trempealeau. The areas were hit earlier this month by storms and flooding.
Rich Kramer joins us now to talk about it. He's WPR's reporter based in Eau Claire. Rich, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're seeing this emergency declaration now. Can you tell us about when the storms hit and some of the impact they had?
Sure. This is way back towards the beginning of the month. We're talking about August 10th and 11th. So what happened was, I talked to Jeff Boyne. He's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in La Crosse. A cold front was moving into the area on August 9th. Before, you know, ahead of the cold front, there were some showers and storms. This one that developed was dropped a lot of rain. They moved into the area of Buffalo County, Trempealeau County, very quickly, the early morning, 5:30, 6 a.m. on August 11th. And the storm that hit Buffalo, Trempealeau, and Eau Claire counties, officially, according to the Weather Service, dropped 4 to 8 inches of rain within about 45 minutes. So that's a tremendous surge. Yeah. And some of the local residents, of course, with their own rain gauges, they were reporting up to 11 inches of rain within that same time frame. But according to Jeff Boyne at the National Weather Service, he said that the storm had already lost a lot of its punch by the time that it hit Wisconsin. It was already kind of diminishing. So I guess we sort of dodged a bullet, but it still caused a lot of havoc. A gauge, the National Weather Service has river gauges throughout Wisconsin, throughout the rest of the nation. And a gauge on the Trempealeau River at the town of Dodge hit 11.5 feet. And it, for comparison, that's normally right around 5 feet deep there.
Wow.
And the record of all time was in 2010 for 12.8 feet.
I remember seeing the headlines and pictures of flooding. How much damage has lasted beyond the initial event, Rich?
Well, they're still trying to figure that out. There's, you know, the county, the towns, they're all still surmising the damage, if you can believe that. According to the Trempealeau County, they had around $300,000 to $400,000 in damage. Buffalo County seemed to have the most. Right now, totally preliminary, they're looking at $1.3 million in damage, but that's just to county roads. That doesn't have anything to do with private property, private road damage, driveway damage. So it's quite a mess.
Now, we've been hearing, of course, about the flooding in Louisiana. Thankfully, in this case, it wasn't anything that bad. But are we expected to see a lot of damage to people's homes from flooding?
Yeah, they're still trying to find that out. Unfortunately, since this wasn't a federal disaster declaration, they're still trying to figure out whether private citizens will get anything in the form of assistance. I talked with Marvin Meyer. He's the town of Gilmanton board chair, and Gilmanton really was kind of highlighted as getting hit pretty hard. Their flooding came from Elk Creek, which is a little tiny, you wouldn't think twice about it if you drove past it on the highway. It's just something you can walk across normally, but he told me that this is the worst he has ever seen. He's lived in this area his whole life. He said that their damage to their roads, just their town roads, was about $170,000. And so I wanted to get a picture of how bad it was, and I asked him how bad the flooding was, and here's what he had to say.
Some of the properties that were flooded below our bridge had water as high as, I'd say, 8 to 10 feet above their basements or their lawns. I mean, up into the first floor, 8 to 10 feet high. And
so this small little creek that runs through town, they were saying that because the bridge was pretty new, the bridge stood fast, and as material started piling up against the bridge, that caused even more flooding. So you saw this huge surge of water. But they're still trying to figure out just what it costs, what they'll have to do to fix the town roads. There's still five roads that are out. And they're looking forward to this possible funding that will come from the state of Wisconsin, also from the federal sources, but they're worried about how they're going to pay for it up front.
Talking to WPR reporter Rich Kramer about the storms and flooding, the damage they did in western Wisconsin counties earlier this month, and this declaration from Governor Walker declaring an emergency in those counties to help with the cleanup. Now, as you mentioned, Rich, this is not a federal declaration, but what does it mean to have this Wisconsin state of emergency in place?
So basically what it means is that Wisconsin has a disaster fund that helps local governments with their infrastructure. What the locals are hearing, this Marvin Meyer told me in the town of Gilmanton, is that they're looking forward to getting a 75% reimbursement, basically, for their town roads. But here's what he had to say about that, because the fact that he's looking at over $100,000 in damage, about $170,000, and you can imagine a town budget is pretty small. So here's what he said about the possibility of the funds coming from the state.
The rub sort of comes because we have to repair the roads and pay for the repairs up front, then submit it to the state to get our 75% back, which takes maybe up to 2 months to get our 75% back. And I don't understand how we're going to be able to pay for it in full in advance of getting the reimbursement.
So Meyer basically said that they're probably looking at taking out a loan, and they still have to figure out how much, what the grand total is before they go to the bank and try to get a loan for the repairs.
And I imagine Gilmanton isn't the only place that saw this kind of local road damage. He's probably not the only local government leader in this situation.
Just from the basic, you know, the quick round of calls I made today, found out that town of Alma, along close to the Mississippi, also got hit pretty hard, and they're looking at the same thing. Tomorrow in Buffalo County, there's going to be a meeting of community, town officials, county officials, to kind of go over their options for private citizens. There's a possibility that there could be some kind of a community block grant thing, basically a loan from the state that they might be able to help private individuals pay for some of the cleanup, but still a lot of questions there. And because this wasn't declared, you have to hit $8 million in damages to qualify for federal emergency management assistance, but they're nowhere near that, so they're kind of in limbo.
Rich, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date on all this.
Thank you.
That's Rich Kramer, WPR News reporter based in Eau Claire. He talked to us from our studio there. He joined us to talk about the flooding and storm damage in the western part of the state. Governor Scott Walker just declared a state of emergency there. There are a lot of headlines about ways to increase brain power to help prevent Alzheimer's and dementia and just general mental decline, particularly for people who are aging. But is there any science to back up these stories?
Well, our next guest donated his brain to science, so to speak, for 4 months to find out. He tried a lot of methods that are supposed to increase your brain power, and he's here to tell us how it went. Dan Hurley is a contributor at Discover Magazine who wrote about his experience, and he also writes for the New York Times Magazine, the Washington Post, and The Atlantic. He's the author of the book Smarter, The New Science of Building Brain Power. Dan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, Dan, this subject has been one that's interested you for a while. What's the fascination there?
You know, I began doing an article about 7 years ago about a guy who was working with young people with Down syndrome who he had a medicine that he was testing in a big clinical trial to improve their intelligence. And I thought, gee, if that is possible, what about people with, you know, quote-unquote normal levels of intelligence? And I looked in and found that this whole new field was bursting open of research into something that used to be considered impossible, improving intelligence, increasing your ability to deal with the world. And it's been a really fun ride to watch as this science has been evolving while I've been writing about it.
Right. I mean, the idea is pretty tantalizing that we can get older, but we can keep our brains in fighting shape by doing some of these puzzles and exercises and other therapies. But is there science there? Is there agreement about whether or not some of these things actually work?
So there's more evidence in favor of these various kinds of brain training approaches than there is for, say, taking a daily multivitamin. You know, I once wrote a book about the crazy world of dietary supplements where, you know, people take all sorts of things that not only are they proved to not work, but some of them have been shown to be unhealthful. But everybody seems to think that vitamins and supplements are the way to go, whereas there's a lot of skepticism about brain training, and some of that has been fed by news reports of, like, Lumosity, this company that is everyone's heard of. They got fined by the Federal Trade Commission for making claims beyond what their scientific evidence showed. But there is a lot of incredible research. There's large randomized trials involving thousands of people showing significant benefits for all sorts of approaches.
And are we just talking about older people here, or, you know, could someone in their 20s try this stuff and get a benefit?
Well, the most remarkable piece of evidence for older people was actually published after my article came out. It was only about a little more than a month ago. This large study found that people who engaged in 10 to 14 sessions, up to 14 hours of training on this one kind of brain game, it's called a useful field of view, in which you try to see objects on the periphery of your vision. They had a dramatically reduced incidence of dementia 10 years later, which is kind of incredible. There's been no drug, there's been no treatment known to do anything like that. And this was a very large, it's about 3,000 people in this study, supported by the National Institute of Aging. And that's, you know, I consider that just plain crazy remarkable and, you know, very strong science.
Well, and you wanted to try your hand at some of this, or I guess I should say your brain at some of this, and you tried a whole passel of these exercises.
Yes.
Before we get into the different results, tell us, give us the overview. What did you try?
Okay, so the best known thing, the best proved thing is physical exercise. Anyone who gets up and does physical exercise maybe loses some weight, but just, you know, improves their physical well-being, they are going to see significant benefits for their mind. Diabetes is strongly associated with, you know, decreased cognitive functioning after a long time. I actually have had type 1 diabetes, which I developed while living in Wisconsin when I was going to Beloit College as, you know, a 20-year-old. Diabetes is really not good for the brain. So exercise is a big thing. There is also something called transcranial direct current stimulation. Sounds like something out of a Frankenstein movie.
Right, it doesn't sound fun.
No, but it's painless. This is about as powerful as my 9-year-old just got one of these fake, you know, little trick things that you shake somebody's hand and it buzzes their hand, like, you know, it hardly hurts at all, and you can't even feel it, and it there's been hundreds of studies now showing that this helps improve your efforts. I did it at a Harvard laboratory. I don't recommend people going out and trying this on their own. I did Lumosity. I did Lumosity for a long time, for months. This game that is described in the study that showed, you know, cut the rate of dementia in half. That's available on a website called BrainHQ, brainhq.com. And I did their games for about 10 times. And so I've done all those things. I also tried mindfulness meditation, but I didn't get very far because I've got a dog and a daughter, and it just was impossible.
So maybe to be continued on that one.
Yes.
Well, okay, so let's start with some of these games, because these are popular. A lot of us see them advertised on television and elsewhere. So you tried Duel and Back was one along with...
Duel...
Yeah, let's start there.
So Duel and Back. This is something that caught a lot of attention a few years ago. This was a study of this thing was the first to show that you could increase your actual intelligence by playing a game. This is something where if you imagine a tic-tac-toe board, so there's three squares on the top, there's three squares on the middle, and three squares on the bottom. So an item, one of those is getting filled up for a moment, and you see it, you know, you see an X in there, and then another one gets filled up, and then another one gets filled up. And you've got to remember, as it keeps moving forward, which was the last one that happened? Where was it last time? And if it repeats on that from the last time, you hit a little button on your computer. But then they make it harder. Where was it two times ago? And it's moving forward. It keeps changing. It's like jumping around like a frog going from one to the next. And every time it hits again on something it was two times ago, you press the button. Then it goes to three times ago. I got up to five times ago, and even a few times I got up to six times ago.
So you got better.
Insanity. You get better. What's crazy about this game is insanely difficult. It's so annoying that when you look at it, you think it's impossible, and when you try it, you want to throw your computer across the room because it's very hard. It's not like doing a crossword puzzle. It's not like anything normal. It seems like I can't do that. But once you sit there and you try, within do it once and you go, I think I'm beginning to see what this is about now. And then you keep doing it. And what's crazy about it is you get better. And you can't quite figure out how you're getting better because it's moving so fast that you really don't have any strategy or tricks to do better. It's not like a crossword puzzle where you learn, what are the typical kind of clues. There's nothing like that you can go on. Your mind just gets better at tracking this thing, and it seems to be associated with improved intelligence.
I mean, did you find that? Did you notice any difference when you weren't playing this game? Did you feel smarter?
So, all I can tell you, you don't feel smarter. I mean, there's no way to feel smart. What does smart feel like?
Well,
I don't know.
You feel like you're on your game. You've got quick reflexes.
Well, what I can tell you is that, I did all these different things. I did the physical exercise. I did the, getting my brain zapped. I did these other kinds of exercises. And I did find I was working more efficiently. Since then, I certainly am a faster worker. I don't know how that's happened. Maybe I'm just, continuing to evolve in my work. That's possible. I wrote it wasn't quite a bestseller, but it was kind of, it did really well. And, everybody, my publisher was very happy, and I had never done that before. So I felt like it's made a difference in my life. But, one person's report scientifically is not meaningful. I mean, I did it to see what it's like, and I reported my experience. But what people should rely on is that there are studies published in major journals, peer-reviewed studies, randomized, placebo-controlled, that have found again and again that these various approaches improve important cognitive skills for dealing with daily life, not just quote-unquote being smarter, but you know, avoiding dementia and being able to function in daily life. So it's there's a lot of great science there, and it continues to evolve.
And Dan, if you could just recommend one thing, I mean, you tried a whole bunch of things, including, we forgot to mention, learning to play the lute.
Yeah.
But if you could mention just one thing that people could try that you think would give you a decent bang for your buck, what do you suggest?
I'm going to say two things. I think that some level of physical exercise, you know, I mean, we all know we should be exercising, but especially for people as they're getting older or if they're concerned about losing it, physical exercise is one of the best ways. And it doesn't matter, you know, we're not talking about being a marathon runner. We're just talking about moving and getting up there and maybe joining the Y or doing something if you are concerned. And then I think Brain HQ's game where it's called Double Decision. And that, you know, brainhq.com, I think that's the one where randomized placebo-controlled studies showed 14 hours on it cut the rate of dementia 10 years later in half, which, I mean, seems incredible. And, you know, there's got to be more studies because that's just so unprecedented that it's almost hard to believe. But I think that is worth someone's effort.
Well, Dan, thanks a lot for joining us and telling us about it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
That was Dan Hurley, contributor at Discover Magazine, joining us to talk about his experience experimenting with brain-boosting games and other activities.
The U.S. Supreme Court has been a hot topic on the presidential campaign trail, with an open seat remaining unfilled as the Senate has refused to confirm President Obama's appointee, Merrick Garland.
With other justices expected to retire in the coming years, the next president could make multiple appointments to the court, and those appointments could affect American law and policy for decades. And partisans in both major parties are making the case that whether you like their candidate or not, you have to weigh the impact of those court appointments.
Kimmy King joins us now for a look at the high-stakes world of Supreme Court appointments. She's a professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back. It's quite an election season we've got here, huh?
Well, it sure is. And this Supreme Court, I know it's just one facet, but it's a fascinating facet. I want to start off, Kimmy, by listening to a bit of an interview we did with Gabe Roth. He's with the group Fix the Court. They're calling for term limits for the Supreme Court in the form of 18-year appointments to the court. Here he is.
These are unaccountable individuals who are serving 30, 35, sometimes upwards of 40 years on the court. And given the fact that, you know, with paralysis in Congress and challenges gridlock between the legislative and executive branches, the Supreme Court has become so powerful, and we don't believe that any individual should hold power for that long. So the idea that regular terms, fixed terms, be implemented is something that we feel is more becoming of a modern democracy such as ours.
Gabe Roth there from the group Fix the Court. So, Kimmy, in this day and age, is there a case to be made that our Supreme Court justices are too powerful?
Well, and also this issue of whether or not they have outserved their usefulness, having been on the court for years. Remember that this was at the heart of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's gripe about the nine old men back during the New Deal. So, yes, that argument is there. But the biggest obstacle to that is going to be that you're going to have to pass a constitutional amendment to do it, because Article 3 structures lifetime service. The founders were really worried that if you didn't allow judges impartiality, or if that you set time limits, or you linked it in some way to political institutions, the consequence would be that the courts would become partisan. Well, the reality is the courts are partisan. They've always been partisan. But nonetheless, this idea of life tenure has been around a long time. And in the 1930s, when it was challenged, it got slapped down hard.
Right. So the idea here is that not only justices don't have somebody who can fire them. I mean, I guess they can be impeached. That doesn't come up very often. I think they'd have to be breaking some pretty serious laws to get there. But also, if they had a limited term, well, they might be thinking, what's my next job going to be after this whole Supreme Court gig is up? Now, with that life appointment, they don't need to worry about that at all, I guess, is the thinking there?
Well, it's actually also a larger issue. Supreme Court justices don't go on to the Supreme Court because it's a job. It's actually a really low-paying job. Chief Justice John Roberts or Scalia at the height of his popularity could have easily walked off into law firms with million-dollar figures and bonuses. So it's not so much that. I think the concern is really more that you become ideologically entrenched, having served on the court for so long, and that over time that undermines democracy.
But that's what's happened with life appointments is what a lot of people are saying.
Right.
When you look at the justices, you can say on any given issue with most of the justices, you know which way they're going to rule on any given issue, often anyway.
That's right. Although, you know, look at Justice Blackmun. Justice Blackmun really changed over the course of his life. He became very unhappy with the death penalty. And you just never know what direction justices will take. And if we look at justices like Justice Holmes going way back in time, I mean, he really came into his own in some ways as being a libertarian on the court in ways that he did not start out as a libertarian on the court.
Talking to Kimmy King, political scientist at the University of North Texas, looking at the U.S. Supreme Court, the high stakes of court appointments in presidential elections. And let's get to that, Kimmy. We've got this Supreme Court appointment on the table. The U.S. Senate is saying, no, we're going to hold off there. It seems like this is the timing of that and the presidential election, plus more likely retirements from the court. It seems like this is a big year for Supreme Court appointments in the presidential campaign.
It certainly is, and one of the things that's interesting is the way both the Democrats and the Republicans have kind of done political spin on appointments during election years. And the fact of the matter is that, yes, there have been appointments in election years, but they have been much more historical going back in time. The one that folks will point you to very clearly is Kennedy's case when he was appointed in 1988. But his vacancy had come up in 1987. And Kennedy's also difficult because, you know, speaking of justices changing their mind or at least moving in different ideological directions on the court, Kennedy has really become the centrist at the heart of the court that has worked, especially in the last decade or so, to forge compromises on the court regarding the conservatives and the liberals. So this is really complicated about how we see justices during election years.
Now, the stakes may be extra high because of this deadlock, sort of 4-4, we're short one justice. I want to play President Obama talking earlier this summer. This is after a 4-4 tie in the Supreme Court on a challenge to his executive order on immigration.
Now, as disappointing as it was to be challenged for taking the kind of action that other administrations have taken, the country was looking to the Supreme Court to resolve the important legal questions raised in this case. Today, the Supreme Court was unable to reach a decision. This is part of the consequence of the Republican failure so far to give a fair hearing to Mr. Merrick Garland, my nominee to the Supreme Court. It means that the expanded set of common sense deferred action policies, the ones that I announced 2 years ago, can't go forward at this stage until there is a ninth justice on the court to break the tie.
President Obama sounding a bit frustrated with the state of affairs in the U.S. Supreme Court. Kimmy, this is kind of a weird situation. We haven't been in this, had a shorthanded Supreme Court that often, have we?
No, we haven't. Although if we go back in time and you look look at the Supreme Court appointment debacle that went down in the late 1960s when they were trying to elevate Justice Fortas to Chief Justice Fortas, and then that was a disaster, and then Thornberry was supposed to take his place. That's clearly the prototype of something going up in flames. And there was concern that over the course of that process, especially with the court being embroiled in a contentious set of Senate hearings on the nominations, that as a result, everything gets lost in the shuffle, right? And democracy loses, and they can't decide these cases. So there is that concern, and it's not just with instances like the Texas case where they were clearly deadlocked. We can see in the Zubik versus Burwell case regarding contraceptives for whether religious organizations have to, as part of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, provide contraceptives. The court in that one did something that everybody has really kind of said, ugh. They said, we are vacating lower court rulings, and we are going to force you to go back and reach a compromise. So the 4-4 deadlock between conservatives and liberals is resulting in basically dragging out court cases, forcing lower courts to go back through these issues they've gone through before, simply because we're waiting time until a new set, you know, so we get that person that can break the deadlock so that after you've gone through all this, it can go back up to the Supreme Court, only to have the whole thing completely vacated, and now you've wasted everybody's time and millions of dollars. So this is really difficult for the Senate, especially because everybody's watching them. Did you see the new thing that's out saying that there's a 60% chance the Senate's will take, that the Democrats will take the Senate? That has been interesting to watch because Grassley just announced a little while ago, and like literally hours ago, that he would consider the nomination of Merrick Garland if Clinton is elected in November while Obama is still a lame duck president. That's an indication that the political earth is shifting a little bit.
The fear that they might get Merrick Garland, who's not viewed as an extreme liberal, the worry that Hillary Clinton might appoint more liberal and possibly younger.
That's correct. And not only that, but let's remember Ginsburg really wanted to retire. This notion that there could be nominations with a vengeance, right? Ginsburg says, that's it, I'm stepping down, start appointing away. And other justices who may be unhappy about the politicization of the court with all of this that has gone on may just say, we're done here. This business of partisan bickering needs to end. I'm tired of being part of this institution.
Well, I'll need to brush up on my judicial resume and get that in there, I guess. We're talking to Kimmy King from the University of North Texas Political Science Department, looking at U.S. Supreme Court appointments and the politics behind them, from stalled confirmations to presidential campaign rhetoric.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. When you vote for a presidential candidate, are you thinking about Supreme Court appointments? Is the court too powerful? Has it become too politicized? Would you like to see changes, maybe things like term limits for justices? You can call us right now at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about U.S. Supreme Court appointments and how high the stakes have become in presidential elections, with the possibility of appointees serving for multiple decades on the nation's highest court. Political scientist Kimmy King is with us from the University of North Texas.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think the stakes are too high? Should we change the way Supreme Court appointments work? Would you support, I don't know, term limits for justices? Does the court have too much influence on American politics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller now. Steele is on the line in Appleton. Hi, Steele.
Yes. During John Roberts' confirmation, I was driving from Wisconsin to Washington State, and so luckily I could hear NPR all the way, basically. And he had made a comment that the Supreme Court takes issues because our elected officials cannot collaborate to make an issue. And so it's an easy out for them, and they just send the lawyers to the court, and that's it.
Steele, thanks for the call. And even since that confirmation came in, I think a lot of people, the phrase dysfunction in Congress, gridlock in Congress, we hear that again and again. So is it being left more and more to the Supreme Court to clean up a mess?
Well, that's actually much of the speculation, that it's this political volleyball that nobody wants to touch, and it doesn't matter whether it's affordable care or it's marriage equality or it's voting rights or it's immigration, that because we are divided as a country, our courts as an institution, you know, may get stuck with some of that. But, you know, down through history, courts have always been called in when there have been these kinds of divisions in American history. If we go back to the founding of the U.S. Supreme Court, I mean, there was a movement in 1802 to abolish it. Why? Because the claim was it was being packed with partisan hacks and that the courts were going to try to usurp power from the other institutions of government. And the court came in Marbury versus Madison, established judicial review and calmed the waters, and we moved on. So we've always had these battles over whether appointments to the Supreme Court are high stakes and whether or not they're politicized and what should the role of the court be. Thomas Jefferson talked about abolishing the court altogether because he didn't even want the court to hear Marbury versus Madison.
Steele, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Michael with us in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hi. I think that the stakes in this election are so high that the who's going to pick or who our next Supreme Court justices are going to be is just a minor blip in this whole thing. You know, I don't think you can go too far extreme one way or the other with a Supreme Court justice, but if one of our candidates get in, not mentioning any names, we're going to see a country that is going to be so extreme and a country that is just going to be struggling for his survival, much less having to worry about who's sitting on the Supreme Court. So I think this election is so different than any. I'm 70 years old, and any election I've ever seen in my life, and everybody's in the same boat, that all the previous rules about Supreme Court and the gun issue and all these things don't even matter, because I always like to say about this election, just think country first. All those other little issues are just side issues.
Michael, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. So, Kimmy, a couple things there. One, the Senate does get to weigh in. They have to confirm the candidates. So that limits maybe the impact of the president on the appointment. Michael's saying there's bigger issues for people in this election. Do you think, or to what extent do you think voters are thinking about the Supreme Court appointment issue as they weigh Trump or Clinton or no one or someone else?
I think that your caller makes an excellent point, and I do think that, you know, there was much conjecture over these kinds of issues with Supreme Court appointments and the high stakes last March and April, but the events over the summer have really in some ways eclipsed the issues regarding the Supreme Court. And I think that heading into the national election, one of the things that's sort of striking is how the Supreme Court has fallen off of the agenda. It will come back on beginning in October. People are going to make much more of a issue of it because the court will come back into session. So you'll see some of it come back up, but then compared to all of the different really contentious issues that we have going on surrounding the election, you know, voter identification and the status of the Affordable Care Act, just, you know, a wide variety of issues. In essence, the Supreme Court sort of being pushed out. And also the Supreme Court has a history of surviving and doing okay. These struggles of the Supreme Court that come up every so often when we have these kinds of contentious battles, at the end of the day, 2-3 years on down the road, it's smoothed over and we move on.
Michael, thanks for that call. We're talking to Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas, about Supreme Court politics, the politics of court appointments. Reed is with us next in Clintonville. Reed, hi.
Yes, good afternoon.
say my question is this. Prefaced first by saying, if I'm not mistaken, as I remember it, George Bush appointed Chief Justice Roberts as Chief Justice, when Chief Justice was appointed to the Supreme Court. Now, should the next president appoint one or more Supreme Court members, and one definitely, will that president, whomever it is, be able to reappoint a new Chief Justice? Could they select from the court or the candidate that they put up? Could they make that candidate the Chief Justice?
Interesting, Reed. Gotcha. Kimmy, can Chief Justice Roberts be bumped down to an inferior normal court justice by the next president?
No, he cannot. And again, that's Article 3. That's a great question. And doesn't the next president wish that they could do that, right? but no, that is not the case. You were appointed and you are in there and you're appointed for a life term. And so what's interesting is the strategy that presidents take, like LBJ wanting to elevate Fortas, who was on the court already as an associate justice, to make him a chief justice, because that vacancy had opened up. But that's the only reason why he was able to do that. Or you might go a different route, like Bush did, and he had originally been considering Roberts for a different position and then said, hey, you know what, the Chief Justice position just became vacant. That's the one I would like you to take. But it's only when the Chief Justice position is vacated.
Reed, thanks for that question. One weird thing with lifetime appointments, and we Americans, we're living pretty long these days. We can see people like the late Justice Scalia serving multiple decades. So there's a motivation to appoint as young a justice as you can, somebody in their 40s, though Merrick Garland is, I double-checked, 63. But is that a weird incentive? You've got this power of appointment. You want to get the youngest person in, so you leave your presidential stamp on the Supreme Court for 20, 30 years down the road?
Oh, absolutely. And it is clearly one of the things that presidents look at. You know, there was much conjecture over Justice Thomas that he was so young when he was appointed, or Justice Alito that they would serve, you know, for the potential to serve for decades. Our current court, though, we've got three justices who are 77 or older. We've got Ginsburg, who's 83, and Kennedy, who's 80. And we've got a good chunk of older folks. If you look back before the 1970s, the average age of a Supreme Court justice was 68. The average age today is 78. And so because we as a population are living longer, the people who serve in our institutions are also living longer.
And at the other end of things, does that lead us to some weird, ghoulish political calculations, which Supreme Court justice might pass away during the next president's term?
Oh, absolutely. And you have to recall that FDR, who wanted to pack the courts, who was stymied, who his plan to kind of alter the courts so he could put his partisan and ideological favorites on, because that court was not doing what he wanted them to decide for different New Deal cases. I mean, ultimately, FDR got the last laugh, because while the court-packing plan he wanted went down in flames, the justices, remember the nine old men that he wanted to get rid of, they began dying off. And over the course of his term, FDR was able to appoint a record number of 8 justices to the Supreme Court. So your logic is spot on, Rob.
We're short on time, but I mean, I get that as an institution it's worked, but it's also kind of a weird way to do things, isn't it? Wait until that generation of justices dies?
It is, and there have been justices who have said, you know, you will take me off this bench in a box. And then you also have other justices like Justice Souter who said, you know what, I've hit 69, I'm out of here. See ya. I want to go enjoy my life. But it has been the more common occurrence that they do what Scalia did, and that is hold on until the bitter end.
Well, Kimmy, we'll let you go and enjoy your life now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Love public radio.
That's Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas, looking at the high political stakes behind U.S. Supreme Court appointments. Still time for you to share your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page.
A
As we heard in the news yesterday, legendary actor and Milwaukee native Gene Wilder passed away at the age of 83.
You stole fizzy lifting drinks. You bumped into the ceiling, which now has to be washed and sterilized, so you get nothing. You lose. Good day, sir.
Would you mind telling me whose brain I did put in?
And you won't be angry?
I will not be angry.
I don't know if you ever heard of me before, but I used to be called the Waco Kid.
That was Gene Wilder as Willy Wonka, young Dr. Frankenstein, and the Waco Kid in Blazing Saddles.
Wilder was born in Milwaukee in 1933. His acting career started in a local production of Romeo and Juliet at the age of 15, and he graduated from Washington High School in Milwaukee's Sherman Park neighborhood.
Big part of my life, Gene Wilder, Milwaukee native. Those three movies, one called The Frisco Kid I remember watching, and The Silver Streak I watched a lot for some reason as a kid.
I had never seen a lot of Wilder until my kids got obsessed with Willy Wonka, which I find sort of half genius and half genuinely disturbing. It's one of a kind. That's for sure.
Farewell to Gene Wilder from us here at Central Time.
Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination.